expelled from heaven because in the end he's deferential to Amaterasu. This is, in legendary format, a description of a political compromise between two rival kingdoms. The rulers of Izumo can still be dragon slayers in their own mythology so long as they recognize the sun goddess as their superior. So, underneath all these supernatural exploits, the stories of the Kojiki can actually be read as political legends. These are the stories of rival clans with rival gods coming together into a single kingdom with a single mythology. Now, part of the inspiration for compiling the Kojiki in the 700s was to use these stories to support Japanese kingship. Ancient Japan's emperors claimed descent from these gods as part of their mandate to rule. And what's remarkable about the Japanese monarchy is that it still draws legitimacy from these ancient myths. The reigning emperor in Japan still enjoys a special connection to Amaterasu, the sun goddess. And when these ancient myths are fused with modern political practice and modern political sensibilities, the results are quite often very strange. For example, in 1990, when Emperor Akihito formally ascended the throne, the foreign press did not quite know what to make of his Daijousai, a ceremony in which the new emperor communes with the spirit of Amaterasu. There's a ritual bath, special foods, including sacred rice, but the most intimate rituals are closed to the public. And some Japanese scholars have observed that because there is bedding in the inner sanctum, the new emperor's connection with Amaterasu involves some sort of symbolic sexual union. The Imperial Household Agency insisted that while Amaterasu does indeed rest on the bed, the new emperor does not touch the bed. Nonetheless, even though foreign reporters tried to be respectful, the emperor's connection to the ancient gods just seemed a little bit weird and kinky. Of course, 45 years earlier, in 1945, the same imperial connection to the ancient gods had seemed very different. Then Emperor Hirohito's connection to the ancient gods was seen as militaristic, fascistic, and dangerous. The U.S. occupation insisted that Hirohito renounce his divinity, and he dutifully read a proclamation declaring that he was not a living god. Now, I think this range of Western interpretations, going from a little bit weird to downright fascistic, are symptoms of trying to connect ancient rituals to modern politics. And we probably have the same problems in Europe if, for example, the king of Sweden claimed to have Thor's hammer, or some other direct link to the Norse gods. Or if the king of England, upon taking the throne, had a ritual meeting with the spirit of King Arthur, complete with a symbolic handover of the sacred sword Excalibur. So what's distinctive about the Japanese case is not that Japanese mythology is uniquely strange. It's that in Japan, the remote and distant past is not that remote and distant. Instead, particularly in the case of institutions like the Imperial House, we find that ancient rituals are still a part of contemporary life.
Lecture 3, The Emergence of the Ritsuryo State.
In the early 500s, Japan was little more than a loose confederation of clans, with an emperor who was merely the nominal chief of the chieftains who led those various clans. But beginning in the late 500s, leaders in Japan embarked on an unprecedented project of state building. And by the late 700s, Japan was a highly centralized state, with an emperor who claimed direct authority over all Japanese territory. This was also an ambitious state that described itself as equal to the Chinese Empire. Today we'll talk about the how and the why of this remarkable change. But before we dive into those details, let me make an important note about periodization. In most encyclopedia entries or in textbooks on Japan, you will probably find ancient Japanese history broken into three distinct periods. First, there's the Asuka period, which runs from 538 to 710 CE. Then comes the Nara period, which runs from 710 to 794 CE. And that's followed by the Heian period, which runs from 794 to 1185 CE. Each of those names, Asuka, Nara, and Heian, are place names based on the site of the imperial capital during the period in question. And all three sites are in the same general region. Heian today is known as Kyoto, and the older capital of Nara is just 25 miles to the south, and the still older capital of Asuka is another 18 miles to the south. So today we'll be talking about politics in the Asuka, the Nara, and the early Heian periods. And by way of introduction, let's imagine a set of before and after shots for different aspects of Japan. And let's start with a snapshot of politics and economics. So in the 500s, each clan leader governed his own people under his own rules. Commoners paid tribute to local clan leaders. Taxes and ritual offerings were likely fused into one form of tribute. Local lords and local gods were connected, so taxes and tithing were the same. That's our before picture. Now for the after picture. By the end of the 8th century, Japan had a single monarch in Kyoto whose laws applied throughout Japan. This new state wiped out clan boundaries, and at least in theory, the new state counted every person in Japan. It conducted a census that listed the family status of every person and measured all the land in Japan. The new state tried to fit all the arable land in Japan into a neat rectangular grid. Moreover, the central government tried to redistribute all the land in Japan every 6 years so that every adult male commoner had the exact same parcel as every other adult male commoner. And every adult male servant had the exact same size parcel as every other adult male servant. And every adult female commoner had the exact same parcel size as every other adult female commoner. And so on. This was based loosely on Chinese practices. But in Japan, it was an unprecedented new level of national power. Historians call this new centralized monarchy the Ritsuryo state. The term Ritsuryo refers to a system of imperial law that in theory applied to every village in Japan. The system was comprised of two main components: the criminal law, or Ritsu, and the administrative laws, or Ryo. Okay, let's move from political and economic questions to military affairs. In the 500s, armies consisted of small bands of clan leaders and their followers. In the 700s, by contrast, the centralized government tried to draw conscripts from every village in Japan and to create a large national army. How about cities? In the 500s, there were no cities worth mentioning in Japan. The capital cities in the Asuka region were little more than clusters of official buildings. But by the 700s, Japan began building major cities. First, the imperial seat was established in the capital of Nara, and then to an even larger city in Kyoto, also known as Heian-kyo, and that became the official capital in 794. Both of these were carefully planned, neat rectangular cities with a tidy grid of streets running north, south, and east, west. Kyoto was based closely on Chang'an, the ancient capital of several Chinese dynasties today known as Xi'an, and it was more massive than anything before in Japan, measuring roughly 3 miles on each side. And even today, the layout of Kyoto reflects that old grid. And it's worth noting, as an aside, that the layout of Kyoto is in striking contrast to Tokyo. There's no clear grid in Tokyo. Instead, streets in Tokyo form a spiderweb pattern around the Imperial Palace. And that reflects the origins of Tokyo as a samurai castle town. If you're lost in Tokyo, that's kind of the plan. Think of yourself as part of an attacking army. The more lost you are, the better. In fact, the current Imperial Palace at the center of Tokyo was, until 1868, the Shogun's castle. And you can still see traces today of the old moat. By contrast, it's almost impossible to get lost in Kyoto, since the city is in such a neat grid. The streets are even numbered. After First Avenue comes Second Avenue, and then Third Avenue. It's a very different sense of power. Nice straight lines show how the emperor can impose order and structure on the universe. Okay, how about a before and after shot of religion? Well, in the 500s, Buddhism was virtually unknown in Japan. But in the 700s, the state actively embraced and promoted Buddhism, which had reached the country via Chinese monks. In fact, the imperial government built a monastery in every provincial capital. And in the 750s, the state completed one of the largest Buddhist temples in the world, Todaiji in Nara. Even today, the main hall at Todaiji, the Great Buddha Hall, is one of the largest wooden structures in the world. And what's inside the Great Buddha Hall is even more impressive. The world's largest bronze statue of the Buddha, known in Japan as the Daibutsu. The creation of that Buddha statue was a massive technological feat. It's nearly 50 feet tall and weighs 500 tons. The feat itself points to the central government's new ability to gather and deploy prodigious resources, both human and economic. Okay, we've looked at several before and after snapshots of ancient Japan, and they all show a dramatic change that occurred in the space of a mere 200 years from the 500s to the 700s CE. So here's the big question. Why? What prompted Japanese leaders to undertake these massive political, military, and religious projects, most of which were inspired by foreign models? Well, to answer that question, we first have to grasp one fundamental point. The transformation of ancient Japan only makes sense in a broader international context, because Japanese centralization was part of a bigger transnational process, the rise of powerful states in China and Korea. And I think it's useful to consider this in terms of globalization. We can call this ancient globalization because, as we noted in an earlier lecture, we see similar processes more than 1,000 years later in the 1800s and 1900s. Now, here's the big parallel. In both eras, first in the 500s to the 700s, and then again in the 1800s and the 1900s, Japan faced a new challenge, an enormous, powerful, and expansive foreign culture. In the ancient period, that foreign culture was China, the Sui Dynasty, and then the Tang Dynasty. In the modern world, it was the great Western powers, the US, Britain, France, and later Germany. But in both cases, Japanese leaders responded in similar ways. First, with the massive adoption of Chinese ideas and technologies, and then, more than 1,000 years later, with the massive adoption of European and American ideas and technologies. So let's take a closer look at the factors that shaped Japan's ancient experiment with globalization. Let's get into some of the details of geopolitics in ancient East Asia. What was going on in China and Korea that so intimidated the rulers of the Japanese islands? In short, it's the return of a unified China. The first big Chinese dynasty was the Han, but that collapsed in the 200 CE. And over the next 300 years, China was ruled by multiple rival kingdoms, over a dozen kingdoms in the 4th century. Then that consolidated to three in the 500s. the Chen in the south, the Zhou in the northwest, and the Qin in the northeast. In the late 500s, however, the Sui dynasty consolidated and ruled much of the area that's now called China. The Sui lasted only to 618 CE, but the Sui was followed by the Tang dynasty, which endured for three centuries. Tang emperors were at the helm of a powerful, stable, expansive Chinese empire. Now, at a basic level, this Chinese unification inspired Japanese unification. The Tang dynasty in East Asia was like Rome in Europe, unprecedented in its cultural sophistication, art, culture, technology, and also unprecedented in its military prowess. So it was both a positive model of what a state could be and a terrifying threat. The threat to Japan was quite tangible because in the 7th century CE, Tang China intervened close by on the Korean Peninsula, and that served as a catalyst for centralizing authority in Japan. You see, in the 500s, there had been four kingdoms on the Korean Peninsula: Silla, Baekje, Goguryeo, and the Gaya Confederacy. But in the 600s, Tang China helped Silla defeat all other rival kingdoms and become the ruling dynasty of the entire peninsula. This was seen as a serious threat in Japan, especially because Japan was associated with the losing sides, loosely with the Gaya Confederacy and Goguryeo, and much more closely with the Kingdom of Baekje. In fact, Japanese noble families and Baekje noble families had deep connections through intermarriage and immigration. So when the Tang dynasty interfered on behalf of Silla, this was a double threat. Not only was the Tang fighting against the relatives of Japanese nobles, but what would happen if the Tang won? Would they then move on to Japan? So it's against this backdrop of Chinese intervention in Korea that we can really appreciate Japan's dilemma. In essence, a movement towards greater centralized state authority was necessary to deal with a perceived threat from the continent. Now, as we've seen, Japan was really not a unified country in the 500s. Rather, it was a loose confederation of clans struggling for control. And in this environment of battling rival clans, one ambitious house came to the fore, the Soga clan. The Soga were connected to Baekje and to Goguryeo and the Gaya Confederacy. They claimed descent from the legendary Japanese Emperor Kogen, but also from Korean nobles. And crucially, the Soga made no attempt to hide this. Their palace in Japan was called Kudara, which is the Japanese word for Baekje, and they brought over nobles from Baekje to serve as officials in Japan. Now, having gained the upper hand among rival clans in Japan, the Soga were committed to the task of building a stronger central state. And for political models, the Soga looked to China. In addition, they aggressively promoted foreign culture, especially Buddhism. And they were involved in building some of the earliest Buddhist temples in Japan. That drew stiff opposition from other Japanese clans, in particular from the Mononobe and the Nakatomi clans. Those clans were indignant about this foreign influence. In one instance, they supposedly threw a Buddhist statue into a river and burned down one of the Soga temples. And so the Soga responded with force. In 587 CE, they crushed the Mononobe and the Nakatomi in a palace coup. And in 592, they assassinated the emperor. But the Soga decided not to make themselves emperors, but instead to rule through pliant proxies. They married their daughters to emperors, and then they served as high-ranking ministers. But Soga men themselves did not claim the throne. In that capacity, the Soga wielded great influence during the Asuka period, and they effectively drove the great transformation of Japanese society that we've been talking about today, the creation of a centralized Japanese state based on Chinese models. The continental influence was evident everywhere. For example, the Soga introduced a system of court ranks that was almost identical to the system found in Sui China and Baekje Korea. You might think of this as a rudimentary civil service, with grades for each level of rank. These new court ranks trumped older clan titles, and these ranks weren't just numeric. They were named for moral qualities. First was virtue, then benevolence, and then propriety. So a continental moral philosophy, both Buddhist and Confucian, was actually built into the administrative hierarchy of the Asuka period. Now the Soga were importing Chinese ideas partly to press back against China. Remember how the Sui dynasty had looked down on Pimiko? She was just a shaman queen who sent tribute to the great and Chinese civilized empire. Well, the Soga pushed back. They began insisting that the Japanese king was the equal of the Chinese king. In fact, they were both emperors. And the Japanese sent a diplomatic note to the Sui that was both polite and obnoxious. It stated that the emperor, the son of heaven, of the land of the rising sun, was sending his warmest greetings to the emperor of the land of the setting sun. Now, the Soga maintained power for about 60 years, and they were tough. They assassinated their rivals. But in 645, they themselves were overthrown in a coup led by their old enemies, the Nakatomi. Okay, let's think back about this for a moment. Back in the 580s, the Nakatomi had opposed the Soga over the question of Buddhism as a foreign religion. So it would be reasonable to assume that they would reverse the Soga reforms after driving them from power, right? In fact, the opposite happened. The Nakatomi doubled down on continental-style reforms, and they accelerated the process of building a powerful centralized state. And the question is why? Why would clans that had opposed Buddhism and foreigners from Baekje in the 500s, now endorse importing continental ideas and technologies? Well, here are two answers. First, cynically, has any government ever aggressively reduced its own power? When the Nakatomi grabbed the makings of a powerful centralized state from the Soga, why would they want to return to a system where a chieftain's power was limited to his own clan? Second, back on the continent, remember that civil war in Korea? Well, the Tang dynasty is intervening right next door. They are backing Silla against Baekje. And despite their distrust of the Soga clan, the Nakatomi were unwilling to abandon Japanese allies on the continent. In fact, the son of the Baekje king had fled to Japan. So the mid-600s are a very bad time to argue in favor of a weak central state and in favor of a loose confederation of clans. Unfortunately, when Japan tried to help Baekje against Silla, they got clobbered. Japan sent troops, they sent the army, they sent the navy. Supposedly, according to ancient chronicles, they sent over 30,000 men and 800 ships. But they were crushed. In a major battle in 663, the Battle of Hakushinoe, they lost half the fleet, and tens of thousands of men. Now, this development was genuinely terrifying. The Nakatomi must have been asking themselves, what if the Tang-Silla alliance decides to attack Japan? So defeat in Korea actually helped inspire a massive centralization of power, and even more emulation of continental models. Okay, with this historical background in mind, let's go back to those before and after snapshots. Remember how I mentioned that the imperial state tried to compile a massive administrative code governing supposedly all of Japan, all the land, all people, everyone and everything? That makes a lot of sense if we think of a context involving frantic international rivalry. Now, as it turns out, the invasion from the continent never came. But that army that the central government had raised, well, it proved pretty useful nonetheless. The imperial state used it to expand its power on the Japanese archipelago. In the early 600s, most of Japan northeast of present-day Tokyo was wild frontier. Fukushima, for example, the site of the 2011 nuclear disaster, that would have been considered wild frontier in the early 600s. But over the next 200 years, the imperial court pushed its control almost to the northern edge of Honshu, pushed the border north about 300 miles. Meanwhile, to the southwest, the imperial state extended its control over all of Kyushu. Now this raises the question, who was on the other side of the border? Were they politically different, culturally different, physically different? Quite frankly, we really don't know for sure. In the northeast, the so-called barbarians were known as Emishi, and they may be related to the present-day Ainu, and therefore physiologically close to the Caucasian peoples of Siberia and the Amur River Basin. In the southwest, the barbarians were called the Hayato. There, the difference was probably more cultural and political than physical. In any case, whether they were called Emishi or Hayato, barbarian meant people who did not grow rice and did not pay taxes on that rice to the central state. But with the expansion of the imperial state, by the 800s, the capital in Kyoto was actually getting tax revenue from almost everywhere in the three main islands of Japan, Honshu, Shikoku, and Kyushu. This had a permanent impact on Japanese culture. Here's a good example. The ancient system of highways set up to collect taxes from distant corners of the empire, those names survive in the Japanese railway system. If you take the bullet train from Tokyo to Osaka or Kyoto, that line is called the Tokaido Line. That's the name for the ancient imperial highway that connected the capital to the northeastern frontier. Now, even though the Chinese invasion never came, the emerging Japanese state was still determined to impress its neighbors with displays of power. Now, today, if a country wants to do that, the pattern is that you show your technological and economic ascendance by hosting the Olympics. Tokyo in 1964, Seoul in 1988, Beijing in 2008. They were all used to show off the wealth and power of the host countries. But how do you impress the world in the 740s without an International Olympic Committee? Well, the Japanese state decided to build Todaiji Temple. Emperor Shomu was determined to build the biggest Buddhist temple in the world. Biggest outer building, biggest Buddha image. And this really was at the outer limits of Japanese technological ability. According to ancient records, the temple employed 50,000 master woodworkers, over 300,000 smiths and metalworkers, and 2 million ordinary laborers. Now, these have to be exaggerated numbers because the total population of Japan was probably only 4 to 6 million in the 8th century CE. But even so, it was an enormous undertaking. Casting the bronze Buddha alone took multiple efforts. The opening ceremony for Todaiji Temple was attended by monks and officials from around the known world, from Shilla, from Tang China, from Southeast Asia, and from South Asia. A monk from India officially consecrated the Buddha. His name is recorded as Bodhisanya. Now, setting aside the idea that Emperor Shomu was very devout, this massive expenditure makes sense primarily in terms of something like the Olympic Games. Expensive, peaceful propaganda designed to impress an international audience. You build huge, expensive buildings. You invite guests from around the world. And the goal was partly just to send people home saying, wow, what a show. I had no idea that they could stage such an elaborate opening ceremony, that they could build such a big stadium or cast such a big statue. And that's a good closing note for the 8th century. The Japanese elite was determined to impress their nation's power and sophistication upon Asia. which for them was the rest of the world. And being sophisticated meant, in many ways, emulating Buddhism and Confucianism, the philosophies of the continent. And so just like hosting the Olympics, it meant showing off, but in a cosmopolitan fashion. And also, like hosting the Olympics, mounting these impressive projects can be unsustainable. A government can look back at their massive construction projects just a decade later and wonder, we ran up a debt for that? And that's a good perspective on the legacy of the ancient imperial state, the Ritsuryo state. On the one hand, Ritsuryo law in Japan was like Roman law in Europe. It continued to have an influence long after the empire was gone. In fact, the official titles of the Ritsuryo system remained in use until the 1800s. But many of the achievements of the Ritsuryo state began to feel unsustainable rather quickly. They made sense only in terms of furious international competition. So don't just think of a huge Olympic stadium that begins to seem like a waste of money a few years after the games. Think of how the space race was connected to the Cold War. The Russians were the first to put a man in orbit, so the US had to be the first to put a man on the moon. And it was a remarkable achievement. And then, to the dismay of NASA and fans of space exploration, support for the program began to fade after the first lunar landing. Or think of the level of national unity and national mobilization that happens when a country feels threatened. All sorts of domestic conflicts get buried, and everyone buys war bonds. And then the threat passes, and, well, things return to normal. Now, many aspects of the Ritsuryo state were like that. Projects that made sense during a period of national crisis and intense rivalry, but they simply lost support after the crisis was over. So remember how all the land in Japan was supposed to be redistributed every 6 years? And remember how Japan built a national army based on conscription? Well, that made sense if you expect an invasion and you want a massive national army, or if you were determined to impress neighboring countries by hosting the 8th century version of the Olympics. But then the invasion didn't come, and the Olympics were over. And you have a tax burden so heavy that farmers keep running away, and your army is plagued by desertion because farmers don't want to be drafted. The great accomplishments of the Ritsuryo state began to look unnecessary and unsustainable. You can't keep a country on a permanent wartime footing, and you can't host the Olympic Games every 4 years. So by the late 800s, the imperial elite, the courtiers around the emperor, they began to wonder whether this massive central government was worth the effort. Well, we'll return to those courtiers and to the fate of the Ritsuryo system in a later lecture.
Lecture 4. Aspects of the Japanese Language.
It's easy to oversimplify the role of language in a culture. You've probably heard the old chestnut that the Eskimo or Inuit have hundreds of words for snow. That's actually wrong. It turns out to be different forms of the same word for snow. But I think the core idea is valid. First, vocabulary does tell us about what's important to a civilization. The Native Americans of Vancouver Island have dozens of words for salmon. The Sami people of Lapland have hundreds of words for reindeer. And as for the French, well, General de Gaulle famously complained, "How can you govern a country that has 246 kinds of cheese?" But beyond the importance of specific words, language structures make it easier or more difficult to express certain things, such as social status, attitudes towards gender, and emotional states. So I think it's fair to ask the question, what does the Japanese language tell us about Japanese culture? What does it tell us about what people value? Well, as we'll learn today, Japanese language is highly contextual. It's hard to know how to say something in Japanese unless you know the details of the social context. And that reflects a long-standing Japanese concern with order, with hierarchy, and with consensus. We'll also see that Japan has one of the most complex writing systems in the world. And that's largely because Japan adopted ideographic Chinese characters, that is, a foreign script system, even though it has no intrinsic syntactical relation to spoken Japanese. Now, this borrowing of the Chinese script system is just one example of China's deep influence on Japanese culture. And we'll explore some of the linguistic consequences of this influence in a few moments. But first, let's examine the idea I just mentioned, the idea that Japan is contextual and situational, the idea that we need to know the context in Japanese before we can say anything. So many years ago, I was asked to work as a consultant on a short elementary school book. The book was called A Look at Japan, and it should have been a fairly simple job, except that the book was part of a series, and each book in the series began with how to say hello in the language of the country the children were pretending to visit. And this turned out to be a big problem, because there's no simple hello in Japanese. You can say good morning, or good day, or good night, but the only way to say hello in Japanese is haro. So translating something seemingly simple, like hello, is not simple at all. Hello in the morning in Japanese is good morning or ohayo. And that becomes ohayo gozaimasu in a formal situation. Hello during the day is good day or konnichiwa. And in the evening, hello is good evening or konbanwa. So, point one, Japanese is highly situational. When translating something into Japanese, you often need to know the time of day, the time of year, the formality of the situation, the age, the gender, the social status of the speaker, the age, the gender, the social status of the addressee, the age, the gender, and the social status of any third party mentioned. And then the social connections among the speaker, the listener, and the third parties. Are they family members? Do they work for the same company? Needless to say, this is a little bit beyond the abilities of Google Translate. And it makes Japanese arguably the opposite of contemporary American English, which has lost almost all markers of social hierarchy in speech. French has tu and vous, German has du and sie, but American English just has you. So translating the English please or thank you or how are you into idiomatic Japanese becomes astonishingly complicated. Because we need to know, is a mother talking to her young son? Is an employee talking to her boss? Is a college student talking to a friend? But let me give you some concrete examples of how this works. When I say Japanese is situational, we can think of each speech situation as having a position on two axes. One is the social hierarchy axis. Some people are above the speaker, and some people are below the speaker. The second axis is formality. Is it a casual situation or a formal situation? And almost every Japanese verb is different based on these two axes. In fact, Japanese adjectives and many nouns also vary based on these two axes. To see this in action, let's analyze the following situation. A group of Japanese friends from college, they get together for a beer, and one says, "Hey, I saw our favorite teacher, Professor Tanaka, the other day. He's retired, but he's healthy and happy." So let's think about our two axes, social hierarchy and formality. Well, clearly the situation is informal, but Professor Tanaka is the social superior to all the friends. So as a result, the speaker's language has to be honorific but informal. So the guy says, I saw Professor Tanaka as Tanaka-sensei ni ome ni kakatta. Literally, my eyes respectfully fell upon Professor Tanaka. Ome ni kakaru is a respectful phrase that signals the social superiority of the professor. My eyes fell upon instead of just see or meet. But kakatta is the informal form of kakaru because we're amongst friends. Okay, let's tweak this scenario a little bit. Same people, talking about the same professor, but this time the context is not so informal. Maybe we're in front of other people. So ome ni kakatta becomes ome ni kakarimashita, which is the same verb but now in formal form. That longer mashita at the end tells us that it's formal. Okay, one more tweak. Same people, same formal situation, but let's say the subject of the conversation is different. Maybe the conversation is about an old mutual friend instead of the professor. Now that old mutual friend, he's at the same social position as the classmates, so we need to use a neutral verb for to see or to meet, maybe dao. So I might say, Tanaka-kun ni daimashita. I bumped into Tanaka-kun. So first, let's observe that kun is attached to the old friend's name. Kun marks familiarity, especially amongst men. And second, although the root verb dao is socially neutral, it takes the form deaimashita, because we're still in a formal situation. In other words, even though Tanaka is a mutual friend, the verb needs to reflect the contextual mood. Now, as in the previous case, I can make things informal with the shorter verb ending, de'atta, instead of de'aimashita. So if we're back at the bar with friends talking about an old mutual friend, I'd say Tanaka-kun ni de'atta. So think of those two axes. Is the person under discussion above me, a peer, or below me? And two, is this a formal or a casual situation? Now, to English speakers, this might seem rather complicated, but it helps explain how even basic phrases work in Japanese. For example, nothing really corresponds to the English phrase, please. Now, many phrase books often give kudasai as the translation of please, and certainly it has that overall meaning. But kudasai makes more sense in terms of an axis of social hierarchy. Kudasai comes from the verb kudasaru, which means send it down. So saying kudasai marks the speaker as socially below the listener. But that humility is balanced by the form of the verb. The sai suffix is actually a mild command. So kudasai is the gentle command form of the verb kudasaru. So please in Japanese is, could you send it down? By now, you've probably noticed that stuff happens at the end of Japanese verbs. And it's tempting to call this conjugating, but linguists call it agglutinating. Japanese verbs and adjectives add information by adding suffixes. Okay, here's a good example. In English, if the verb is eat, the past passive is was eaten. In Japanese, the verb for eat, taberu, becomes taberareta, was eaten. The past passive voice is indicated by a suffix. So where English adds words, Japanese adds suffixes. Let's look at another example of agglutination. In English, adjectives don't have a tense. Take, for example, the phrase is delicious and the phrase was delicious. The adjective delicious doesn't change from present to past. The sense of time comes from the verb. But in Japanese, the adjective for delicious is oishi in the present, and it changes to oishikatta in the past. The past tense of an adjective is marked with a suffix. And indeed, the more complicated the sentence, the more stuff happens at the end of Japanese words. So an In English, a sentence that needs lots of additional words, in Japanese, it just gets lots of suffixes. Okay, here's a silly example. Although it was delicious, it did not want to be eaten. So in Japanese, that would be oishikatta ga taberaretaku nakatta. So in English, to get that thought across, you use lots of words. But in Japanese, it's just the words delicious, but, and eat, and then a negative past marker, nakatta. All those helper words in English, they become suffixes in Japanese. So we've identified two key features of the Japanese language. Feature one, Japanese is highly context-dependent. And feature two, Japanese agglutinates. Now, to Westerners, these features may make Japanese syntax seem truly weird. And certainly, Japanese is quite different from Romance and Germanic languages. But Japanese is absolutely not unique. In fact, Japanese is similar to a string of languages that run along the Silk Road. Japanese, Korean, Manchu, Mongol, Tibetan, Persian, Armenian, and Turkish. All of these languages agglutinate. And they have very few irregular verbs, but their verbs take lots of suffixes. And because of these similarities, native speakers of Turkish can learn Japanese much more rapidly than native speakers of English. And conversely, when I was traveling in Turkey, I discovered that knowing Japanese helped me make sense of Turkish syntax. Okay, before we leave the second feature, agglutination, let me make one more observation. So far, we've been focusing on how Japanese says things. But just as important as how Japanese says things is what it does not say. Or rather, what's explicit in English but implied in Japanese. For example, Japanese routinely drops pronouns. You rarely say I, me, and you in Japanese. They are not needed. That's largely because those reference points are clear from other parts of the sentence, usually from suffixes to verbs or the type of verb. Think about it. Since we're marking social position in grammar, we really don't need to say explicitly I or me. If the verb is humbly send it down, do I really need to say I humbly ask you to send it down? I and you are just needless extra words. In fact, when the Japanese want to make fun of how Americans sound when they're trying to speak Japanese, they emphatically add words like I and you because it sounds so weird. For example, 私はあなたが言ったことがわかりません is a direct translation of I don't understand what you said. And it sounds completely idiotic. The idiomatic Japanese is just one word, わかりません, don't understand. Instead of saying you in Japanese, speakers will commonly use the person's name with a suffix. And not surprisingly, that suffix marks social status. So if you're talking to Mr. Tanaka, rather than say you, you'd say Tanaka-san. San is the honorific suffix. Or maybe Tanaka-sama, an extra honorific. If he's an old friend, it's Tanaka-kun. Kun is familiar, used primarily by men. And those suffixes, like sama, can attach to things other than names. One of my favorite Japanese phrases is otsukare-sama. Sama attached to the word for tired, which is a polite way of saying you must be tired, but literally it is Honorable Mr. and Mrs. Tired. There are pronouns in Japanese, words for I and you, but those usually come with extra meaning. For example, according to most phrase books, anata is supposedly you in Japanese, but anata has the nuance of a wife talking to her husband. And therefore, if a wife used anata in speaking to her husband, he would never say anata back, but instead he'd say something like kimi. And similarly, first-person pronouns tend to add information about the speaker. Phrase books often say that I in Japanese is watashi, and that works as a fairly neutral, formal first-person pronoun. But there's also atashi, an informal I usually used by women. Boku, that's used by men and boys in casual situations. Ore is a very informal male first-person pronoun. So these are all different I's and U's with extra socially dense implications. Okay, to recap. First, Japanese is highly situational, and nothing, not even pronouns or adjectives, are socially neutral. And second, situational meanings are conveyed through agglutination. Okay, now, as an agglutinating language, Japanese is very different from English and other Western languages. But remarkably, Japanese is also very different from Chinese. And that leads to the third key feature I want to highlight today. Japanese writing is incredibly complex because it's written using a Chinese-based script system, even though Chinese is structurally unrelated to Japanese. Practically, writing Japanese in a Chinese-based script is like writing French with hieroglyphics. And as a result, Japanese has one of the strangest writing systems in the world. Japanese is full of workarounds to adapt Chinese orthography to Japanese syntax. Well, how and why did that happen? Well, Japanese was a fully developed language, fully developed spoken language, by the 400s. It had words for all sorts of basic stuff. Eat, drink, fight, laugh, dog, cat, chicken, fox, hot, cold, wet, dry. But there was no written language. The earliest fragments of writing in Japan are from the 400s, and writing did not become widespread for hundreds of years. It must have seemed sensible in ancient Japan to adapt the Chinese writing system rather than to reinvent the wheel. But it led to two quirks of the Japanese language. One quirk is a double vocabulary. When the Japanese imported Chinese characters, they also imported the Chinese sounds for those characters. So in Japan, almost every Chinese character has two possible readings: the local Japanese reading and a copy of the Chinese pronunciation. Here's an example. The word tonkotsu in the popular dish tonkotsu ramen. Tonkotsu is written with the Chinese character for pig and bone. It's ramen with a rich broth from pork bones. But the common Japanese word for pig is buta, not ton. And the common Japanese word for bone is hone, not kotsu. Buta and hone are the old indigenous words because they were Japanese words for pigs and for bones long before anyone tried to write anything down. But with the importation of Chinese characters, with the importation of those glyphs, came the Chinese sounds. So the ancient Japanese attempt to say pig in Chinese is ton, and the ancient Japanese attempt to say bone in Chinese is kotsu. And by convention, when we put those two characters together, we get tonkotsu. We use the Chinese readings, even though in a different situation, you might read those same characters as buta and hone. It's possible to recreate this partly in English, because English also sometimes has a double vocabulary. English has an older Germanic vocabulary drawn from its Anglo-Saxon roots, and also a huge lexicon of more sophisticated words from the Romance languages. So a colloquial term for the house pet that chases mice and plays with string is cat. That's like the German Katz. But the more sophisticated term is feline, from the Latin feles. Now in English, cat and feline are spelled completely differently. But in the Japanese case, those two words would be written with the same character. And the distinction between cat and feline would be based on context. Okay, here's a real example from Japanese. The two characters for house and make can be read in three different ways. The character for house has the older indigenous Japanese reading of ie and also ya. And make has the older indigenous reading of tsukuru, the Japanese verb for make. But the character for house can also have the Chinese-style reading of ka. And make can have the Chinese reading of saku. So these two characters together can be read as iezukuri, yazukuri, or kasaku, depending on the context. Okay, so the first important consequence of using Chinese to write Japanese is having this doubled vocabulary. The second major consequence is that Japanese needed an additional orthography in order for Japanese people to truly express themselves in Japanese. The Japanese language actually has two phonetic systems to supplement Chinese. Why? Remember all those suffixes that give Japanese verbs their meaning? Well, since Chinese is not agglutinating, there's no easy way to represent those suffixes using actual Chinese characters. So the Japanese developed two phonetic systems to fill the gap, hiragana and katakana. Both are derived from Chinese characters, but they are so highly simplified, they look more like letters than like characters, and they're used only for sound. So, modern Japanese has three different writing systems. But everyone in Japan also knows Roman letters, and Roman letters are commonly used in daily life. So it's actually four writing systems. And if you add Arabic numbers, it's five. That's unquestionably the most complicated writing system in the world. So, we've talked about the importance of context in Japanese, and we've also discussed agglutination and the idiosyncrasies associated with a borrowed writing system. For a fourth and final point, I want to mention one of my favorite aspects of Japanese. Its rich vocabulary of onomatopoetic words. Now, onomatopoeia refers to words that imitate sounds. In English, moo is a good example, and so is oink, and so is meow. But more important is that Japanese uses onomatopoetic words for things that aren't noisy. For example, to be lively or healthy in Japanese is pinpin suru. It's to be pinpin. To be irritated or angry is iraira suru, to be iraira. Sometimes the sound changes with the intensity. Kirakira is to shine brightly, and even brighter is giragira. But perhaps the most striking example is that Japanese has an onomatopoetic word for silence. Shin, or shinto, means silently. So yes, with apologies to both Simon and Garfunkel, in Japanese there is a sound of silence. Now these words can be combined to create new words, and here's an example that's known worldwide. In Japanese, to sparkle is pika pika. And a mouse in Japanese makes the sound choo choo. Hence the Pokemon, Pikachu. It's the electric shining mouse. Now this may seem strange. What does it mean that the Japanese have a sound for irritation, there's a sound for a messy desk, and there's a sound for silence? Well, one argument is that Japanese brains are closer to nature, that they are tuned into sounds that only they can hear. Now that to me is crazy, like the arguments that Japanese intestines can only digest Japanese beef, or that Japanese skis work especially well on Japanese snow. And remember, American English also allows for sound mimesis, wham and pow and socko. And I think the Yiddish term kvetch has done so well in English because it has an onomatopoetic aspect. And if I describe a new colleague as hardworking but kind of frumpy lumpy, I don't think people will complain that frumpy lumpy is not in the dictionary. But Japanese allows these expressions in formal speech. In Japanese, onomatopoetic words aren't just silly like wham and socko. They can be part of a learned vocabulary. In other words, Japanese allows for lots of contained playfulness. Yes, the language has lots of rules, but it also offers lots of places to play within those rules. And that leads back to some generalizations we can make about Japanese culture based on the language. So first and foremost, as we've seen, you can't say anything in Japanese